Blog Talk Radio.
Well, your dad's gum government, you sorry so-and-sos. You got your damn hands in every pocket of my clothes. Well, your dad's gum, dad's gum. Government, you better pay attention. You're setting up there like a fool's convention. Will you get down, get down, get down, government? Uh-huh. Oh, don't you know? Oh, don't you love me sometime? Uh-huh.
Well, welcome everyone to the Handling the Truth. This is Terry Dodd, your host tonight, and my co-host here with me is the Rebel Madman, Mike Gaddy. Mike, would you like to say hello?
Hello, everyone.
So this is going to be another hot topic tonight. I'm really looking forward to this one, Mike, because as I told you, this whole question about original intent has really been modifying my thinking, and I believe this fight for the Bill of Rights is a perfect example of why we should be questioning the whole concept of original intent. I guess we better open this thing right with a prayer. Otherwise, we'll end up with all sorts of technical difficulty and biting our tongues and sticking our foot in our mouths and all sorts of things if we don't
get
headed in the right direction. Almighty Father, we look around us and it's just crazy. It's absolutely nuts in this world today. And you foresaw all of it. And you even gave prophetic language and words to some of those back in the time of the founding of this United States. And we're going to look at that tonight, Father, and we just pray that you help us bring the truth forward. And we pray that the listeners will be patient with us, because some of these topics really push the envelope of comfort for some people. And Father, we don't really want to make people uncomfortable, but if it takes that for them to understand what we're really facing today that started back then so be it. And I just pray that you would keep their ears and hearts open for us tonight. Father, we know you're really in control and that you are the ultimate victor. And that's the one thing that keeps us going, because otherwise we would see such a huge uphill battle right now that we just wouldn't even know where to begin to fight it if it wasn't our contentment, knowing that you ultimately are going to take control of all of this and bring it right. And we also know, Father, that you can make good out of evil, even. And boy, that's a lot of that going on right now. So, Father, we pray that all that's going on could be used to bring people in relationship with your son, Yahshua. Be with Mike and myself tonight and keep us on track. We want to be in your desire, and we pray that your spirit would take control of everything we do and say here. It's in the name of your son, our Savior, our King, Yahshua, that we pray. Amen. Well, Mike, where do you want to start this discussion tonight?
Well, Terry, I have given an awful lot of thought to this over the years, and even lately, I have given it more thought as I watch more on social media. I see more discussions, and I see the delusion that people operate under. And I know we're going to make people uncomfortable right off the bat, but it's the delusion which people believe that we have a Bill of Rights that actually protects our rights. And the ignorance is astounding. Number one is the fact that I don't know what percentage, but I think it would be high, of the number of people that are not even aware that there was no Bill of Rights with the Constitution that left Philadelphia in September of 1787. In fact, a Bill of Rights had been voted down unanimously. So the people who wrote the Constitution did not want a Bill of Rights included. That should be alarming to everyone, because every state at that time had a Bill of Rights, and they insisted upon a Bill of Rights. And if you go look at the states today and look at their constitutions, when you look at their constitutions, the very first thing listed, other than, you know, boundaries of the state in some instances, is first. But there's a Bill of Rights there. And so the people in the states felt like that the most important thing before government, and they put it that way, they placed the rights of the people first. But when they went to Philadelphia, and if we look at the letters, which I think are crucial, and we look at a letter from James Madison to Edmund Randolph in April of 1787, a month before the Constitutional Convention, and he says, and I'm paraphrasing, "We want to eliminate the states from the government except where they may be subordinately useful." So they wanted to destroy the state structure in Philadelphia, and in my opinion, they got it done, because they came up with a highly centralized government, and the states' rights, although we talk about those, they were very much diminished. Because if you look at the Necessary and Proper Clause and the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, Clause 18, and Article 6, Clause 2, you will see that the states have no rights. The federal government is all-powerful. And today we labor under this delusion that, oh, well, we, you know, I remember talking with someone years ago. This is probably 20-plus years ago, Terry. And he says, "Well, there's one thing for sure. We've got the Second Amendment to protect us." And I said, "If the Second Amendment protected our right to keep and bear arms, we wouldn't have thousands of gun laws now, would we? Because each one of them is an infringement upon the right to keep and bear arms." And you get this deer in the headlights look. Well, okay, yeah, we have this right, but the government's, you know, and if you go back to Heller versus D.C., the Supreme Court decision that all of the gun rights people got all excited about, even in writing that decision, Justice Scalia said in the majority opinion that gun rights are subject to reasonable restrictions. Well, it doesn't say that in the Second Amendment. So reasonable restrictions, who decides what's reasonable? Well, the thing that we have to understand is the Constitution left Philadelphia in 1787 and it went to the states. Very quickly, the people in the states began to see that this Constitution did not have a Bill of Rights. So the people started yelling for a Bill of Rights. As a matter of fact, there were three delegates who would not sign the Constitution at the end of September. Because it did not have a Bill of Rights. And George Mason said, "I would rather cut off my right arm than sign this without a Bill of Rights." So in their haste for ratification to get this thing ratified, they found out that there was so many objections to the Constitution because it did not have a Bill of Rights. And they finally realized, the Federalists realized, "We're going to have to promise people a Bill of Rights to get ratification, because it's just not going to happen, because a couple of states threatened to pull out, and Virginia was one of them, New York was another. Hey, we'll just pull out and we'll start another convention. If we can't get a constitution with a Bill of Rights, we'll start another convention. We'll start it all over." Well, the Federalists were not about to let their 4 months or 3 months of hard work go to waste, so they started saying, okay, we'll entertain a Bill of Rights. So the states actually wrote a bill, what they wanted in a Bill of Rights, and they sent it to the first Congress. Well, the thing we have to understand, Terry, is that the first Congress was heavily, predominantly Federalist. The same people who wrote the Constitution and did not want a Bill of Rights were now running the government, which didn't want a Bill of Rights. So you had a Federalist president in George Washington. You had a Federalist vice president in John Adams. You had an all-Federalist federal court, including the Supreme Court. And in the Senate, you had 20 Federalists and 2 Anti-Federalists. And in the House of Representatives, you had 39 Federalists and 11 Anti-Federalists. So what were the chances that the people who did not want a Bill of Rights were going to adopt a Bill of Rights with strength and with teeth? It wasn't about to happen, and it was predicted. Virginia is very illustrative of this because in Virginia, Patrick Henry was so strong in Virginia that he was able to get the only 2 Anti-Federalists into the first U.S. Senate, and that was Richard Henry Lee and William Grayson. James Madison wanted a Senate seat, and Patrick Henry worked like the dickens to make sure that Madison did not become a senator. So because Madison was a hardcore Federalist in the beginning, very much into this mix with Hamilton and the rest. So Madison realizes that he needs to be a part of this government, and Hamilton and the rest of them are telling him, hey, you need to leave New York, where he had been writing the Federalist Papers, helping to write the Federalist Papers and with Hamilton and with John Jay. And Hamilton and the rest of them tell him, hey, you need to get to Virginia and get elected to Congress. Because you lost out, he thought that he would be a shoe-in for Senate, but not with Patrick Henry working as hard as he did. So you had Madison rushing back to Virginia and running for Congress, and he ran for a seat in Congress against James Monroe, and unfortunately for liberty, Madison won. That is, for you trivia fans, that is the only election in American history where 2 future presidents ran against each other. So Madison wins, and in the Congress, he is the person who would be responsible for bringing up a Bill of Rights. Well, Madison, in winning that election in Virginia, had to promise his constituents a Bill of Rights to get elected. And he told them, I promise you a Bill of Rights. If you elect me to Congress, and he campaigned heavily on that, and that, many people say, was the reason he was able to beat Monroe, because he was more active in pushing a Bill of Rights. Not that Monroe didn't, but he was more active. So he goes to Congress on the promise. And we have to also remember that in the Virginia Ratification Convention, Patrick Henry and James Madison had a colossal battle of words. And there were times, even with Edmund Randolph becoming involved, there were times that people thought that there might even be duels coming out of this because their arguments became so heated. So on Patrick Henry, the next to the last day before they voted to ratify, Patrick Henry gave a 7-hour presentation. And, of course, that's a colossal event in history with the lightning hitting outside the building and what have you. But anyway, during this time that Patrick Henry is speaking for 7 hours, James Madison makes a point of moving among all of the representatives that were there in homespun and dressed like basically like Daniel Boone, because they were from the western part of Virginia, which is now Kentucky. And he was there with all of those representatives, promising them that if they would just vote to ratify, he promised a Bill of Rights. So Madison was on the hook. He had no other choice but to push a Bill of Rights if he was to have any credibility in the state of Virginia. But when the first Congress takes effect, they don't want to deal with a Bill of Rights. They don't want anything to do with it. Even though the states have all sent their proposals for a Bill of Rights, which were over 200 proposed rights to be sent to the Congress for approval. And, of course, there were some duplications. So you had something over 100 amendments left after they eliminated the duplicates. And so Madison forms a committee in the first House of Representatives, all of whom were Federalists, and they whittled 100 amendments down to 12 or 14, actually. And they sent 14 to the Senate, which was 20 to 2 Federalists, and the Senate whittled two more off of that number, and it went down to 12, and 12 amendments were sent to the states, and they ratified 10 of those 12, and that today is called the Bill of Rights. But the fights in that first Congress, which we aren't taught about, Terry, the fights in that first Congress for a Bill of Rights are just colossal. And the writings of especially Sentinel was critical in that event. But one of the things I think for the people who are listening, one of the things that we should do is that we should take a look at some of the proposed amendments. And I would like, you know, I don't think there's any way that we have time to list all of the states and all of the amendments that each state sent to the first Congress. Pardon me. But I would like to start with Virginia's, especially since Virginia had the first Bill of Rights in this country's history. So let's look at what the state of Virginia proposed for their Bill of Rights. And number one was that there are certain natural rights of which men, when they form a social compact, cannot derive or divest their posterity, among which are the enjoyment of life and liberty with the means of acquiring, possessing, and protecting property, and pursuing and obtaining happiness and safety. Number two, that all power is naturally vested in and consequently derived from the people, that magistrates, therefore, are their trustees and agents and at all times amenable to them. Number three, that government ought to be instituted for the common benefit, protection, and security of the people, and that the doctrine of non-resistance against arbitrary power and oppression is absurd, slavish, and destructive of the good and happiness of mankind. Number four, that no man or set of men are entitled to separate or exclusive public emoluments or privileges from the community, but in consideration of public services, which not being descendable, neither ought the offices of magistrate, legislature, or judge, or any other public office to be hereditary. Number five, that the legislative, executive, and judiciary powers of government should be separate and distinct, and that the members of the two first may be restrained from oppression by feeling and participating the public burdens, they should, at fixed periods, be reduced to a private station, return into the mass of the people, and the vacancies be supplied by certain and regular elections in which all or any part of the former members to be eligible or ineligible, as the rules of the Constitution of Government and the laws shall direct. Folks, there was term limits that Virginia had asked for in their Fifth Amendment. Okay, let's move to the sixth request. That elections of representatives in the legislature ought to be free and frequent, and all men having sufficient evidence of permanent common interest with and attachment to the community ought to have the right of suffrage, and no aid, charge, tax, or fee can be set, rated, or levied upon the people without their own consent or that of their representatives so elected, nor can they be bound by any law to which they have not in like manner assented for the public good. They meant that on the state level. They wanted the Articles of Confederation that each state could decide against a law or a tax if they wanted to. Okay, let me see. Was I at seven? That all power of suspending laws or the execution of laws by any authority without the consent of the representatives of the people in the legislature is injurious to their rights and ought not to be exercised. Think executive orders. Think about pandemic rules. Think about these things that they wanted as a right for the people. Number eight, that in all criminal and capital prosecutions, a man hath the right to demand the cause and nature of his accusation, to be confronted with the accusers and witnesses, to call for evidence and be allowed counsel in his favor and to a fair and speedy trial by an impartial jury of his vicinage, without whose unanimous consent he cannot be found guilty, except in the government of the land and naval forces, nor can he be compelled to give evidence against himself. 9, that no freeman ought to be taken, imprisoned, or possessed of his freehold, liberties, privileges, or franchises, or outlawed or exiled, or in any manner destroyed or deprived of his life, liberty, or property, but by the law of the land. 10, that every freeman restrained of his liberty is entitled to a remedy, to inquire into the lawfulness thereof, and to remove the same if unlawful, and that such remedy ought not to be denied nor delayed. That's nullification of laws. That in 11, that in controversies respecting property and in suits between man and man, the ancient trial by jury is one of the greatest securities to the rights of the people and to remain sacred and inviolable. 12, that every free man ought to find a certain remedy by recourse to the laws for all injuries and wrongs he may receive in his person, property, or character. He ought to obtain right and justice freely without sale, completely and without denial, promptly and without delay, and that all establishments or regulations contravening these rights are oppressive and unjust. 13, that excessive bail ought not be required.
Mark,
yes, sir. Go ahead.
I hate to interrupt your flow, but I keep hearing the word remedy, and the First Amendment is devoid of a requirement of remedy or even response. So they had all of this in front of their face and deliberately left it out.
Well, of course they did, because as we will get into the letters, and I hope we have time, between people involved in the government and other folks, like even George Washington, there were over 140 letters exchanged about the amendments to be added to the Constitution. And I hope we can get into those, because those letters are so intuitive, because they tell you exactly what the people were thinking. And we don't get that. We're not taught that. We're not taught those things. And yes, what you're saying, Terry, is exactly correct. There was remedies everywhere in the proposed amendments, and there are none in the especially with government now, with this wonderful thing called implied immunity, which government employees have, which basically sets a line that the government cannot be sued for anything they do wrong. But anyway, back to 13, that excessive bail ought not be required, nor excessive fines imposed, nor cruel and unusual punishments inflicted. 14, that every free man has a right to be secure from all unreasonable searches and seizures of his person, his papers, and his property. All warrants, therefore, to search suspected places or seize any free man, his papers, or property without information upon oath or affirmation of a person religiously scrupulous of taking an oath, of legal and sufficient cause, are grievous and oppressive, and all general warrants to search suspected places or to apprehend any suspected person without specially naming or describing the place or person are dangerous and ought not to be granted. That is our Fourth Amendment now, in some manner, which has been completely destroyed and eviscerated by the war on drugs. People have a right peaceably to assemble together to consult for the common good or to instruct their representatives, and that every free man has a right to petition or apply to the legislature for redress of grievances. Now, there they put petition and apply, but they had a remedy in here which we do not have in our present Bill of Rights. That the people have a right to freedom of speech and of writing and publishing their sentiments, that the freedom of the press is one of the greatest bulwarks of liberty and ought not to be violated. That's 16, which is now in the First Amendment, which the Federalists completely destroyed in 1798 with the Alien and Sedition Acts. Because in 1798, this same group of Federalists who wrote the Constitution got passed a law that made it against the law to say anything negative about the government or people in the government. And they even prosecuted a U.S. congressman and sent him to prison for speaking ill of President. And in the and to show you how far the courts were out of shape in the very beginning because of this Federalist domination, Samuel Chase, who was on the Supreme Court in the trial of I was trying to think of the congressman's name. First name was Matthew. Anyway, I'll think of it in a minute. He was charged with being seditious in his speech about the government and the president. And during the charging of his jury, the justice of the Supreme Court, Samuel Chase, told the jury that you are not to judge whether this law is constitutional or unconstitutional, nor does it matter if what he said was true or false. If he said anything bad against the government, he's to go to prison. Doesn't make any difference if what he said was true. Doesn't make any difference if this law is unconstitutional. You send him to prison anyway. And so charged in such a manner, the jury found him guilty. Imagine that.
But, Matthew Lyon.
Yeah, Matthew Lyon. The crazy thing about Lyon was Lyon went to prison and was reelected to Congress while he was sitting in prison. So the people weren't real happy with what happened, obviously. Okay, 17, that the people have a right to keep and bear arms, that a well-regulated militia composed of the body of the people trained to arms is the proper, natural, and safe defense of a free state, that standing armies in time of peace are dangerous to liberty and therefore ought to be avoided as far as the circumstances and protection of the community will admit, and that in all cases the military should be under strict subordination to and governed by the civil power. So, Terry, we've got some people say the show is breaking up. So I've got a couple of messages on that just for your information. Number 18, that no soldier in time of peace ought to be quartered in any house without the consent of the owner, and in time of war in such manner only as the laws direct. That would be our Third Amendment now. That any person religiously scrupulous of bearing arms ought to be exempted upon payment of an equivalent to employ another to bear arms in his stead. Number 20, that religion or the duty which we owe to our Creator and the manner of discharging it can be directed only by reason and conviction, not by force or violence. And therefore, all men have an equal, natural, and unalienable right to the free exercise of religion according to the dictates of conscience, and that no particular religious sect or society ought to be favored or established by law in preference to others. So this was what Virginia sent. Now, many of the other states, they sent similar things. And one of the things also, two sections of rights that the people in the states sent to the government. Number one was what I just read on the Virginia side, was the to protect the people, to protect the people's rights. The other set of amendments that they sent was to alter the government. And in the amendments sent to alter the government under the Constitution, which is what an amendment is supposed to do, to amend every state sent the same a request or the same amendment that no direct taxation ever be allowed to be placed on the people. 11 states send that because at that time North Carolina and Rhode Island were not had not ratified yet. So 11 states sent that, all 11, unanimously it was sent, and this committee, Federalist Committee, kicked that amendment out. Imagine that. Any comments, Terry?
I was just quieting the noise behind me, but your sound tonight is as good as I've ever heard it, Mike. I've heard no breakup of it at all, so I'm not sure what was reported, but I think we're coming through loud and clear. And, you know, this is just more evidence and proof of what we've been saying for weeks and months, actually. And that,
well,
just a lot of deception.
Go ahead.
No, I keep seeing a lot of deception.
Well, the one thing that I would like to read, and I won't read the whole thing, but there is a reason that a little bitty book, which I have in my hand right now, a little bitty book, and the title of it is The Letters of Sentinel, Attacks on the U.S. Constitution, 1787 to 1788, which has all 24 essays of Samuel Bryan. And let me see if I can see exactly how many pages this little book has. It has 144 pages. So in what world, Terry, does the Letters of Sentinel with 144 pages sell for $930 on Amazon if this is not infringement on our First Amendment rights? You can say, okay, you can have all of the First Amendment, you can read all of Sentinel you want to, but it's going to cost you a bunch. So how many people do we have any idea who would step up and say, okay, well, there's that book by Sentinel, and it's got all these wonderful things in it, and all of these attacks on the Constitution of 1787. So we're only going to charge $930 for the book. Now, is there an explanation for that, Terry?
Well, yeah. It means it's rare, which means it's been scrubbed.
Well, the crazy part about it is, Terry, is that these essays are in the public domain, except you can't find them. You know, you can find like 1 through 16 on the internet, if you can find that anymore. But boy, try to find anything past 16 and you're in for a real struggle. For that reason, I would like to read part of Sentinel 19. And this is the one, and you will understand as we get into the language of this. And so Sentinel 19 starts out, and I quote, "My knowledge of the principles and conduct of these men for many years past left me no room to doubt of their insincerity on this occasion." First day with my new lips, I'm sorry. "I was persuaded that all their professions of moderation and assurance of future amendments were founded in deception, that they were but the blind of the moment, the covered way to dominion and empire. Like a barrel thrown to the whale, the people were to be amused with fancied amendments until the harpoon of power should secure its prey and render resistance ineffectual. Already the mask of ambition begins to be removed and its latent features to appear in their genuine hue, disdaining any further veil from policy. The well-born, inebriated with success, despising the people for their easy credulity, think it unnecessary to dissemble any longer. I'm sorry. Almost every newspaper ridicules the idea of amendments and triumphs over the deluded people. Ye patriots of America, arouse from the dangerous infatuation in which ye are lulled, and while it is yet time, strain every nerve to rescue your country from the servile yoke of bondage and to preserve that liberty which has been so recently vindicated at the expense of so much blood and treasure. Upon the improvement of the present moment depends the fate of your country. You have now a constitutional opportunity afforded you to obtain a safe and a good government by making choice of such persons to represent you in the new Congress," this would have been the first Congress, "as have congenial sentiments with yourselves. Suffer not, ye freemen of America, the well-born or their servile minions, to usurp the sacred trust, to impose themselves upon you as your guardians, for whatever professions they may make or assurances they may give you, depend upon it they will deceive you, like the wolf in sheep's clothing, they will make you their prey. Treat with contempt the slanderous arts of the well-born to prejudice you against your true friends, and convince them on this great occasion, by your good sense, union, and vigor, that you are not to be duped out of your liberties by all the refinements of the Machiavellian policy. The future government of these United States, this is critical, the future government of these United States will take its tone from the complexion of the first Congress. Upon this will greatly depend whether despotic sway or the salutary influence of a well-regulated government shall hereafter rule this once happy land. As the legislature of this state have appointed the last Wednesday in November next for the election of the 8 representatives from this state in the new Congress, you ought to be prepared for that all-important day, and as success is only to be ensured by unanimity among the friends, equal liberty, local and personal predilections and dislikes should give place to the general sentiment. Whatever ticket may be agreed to be the majority of the opposition to the new Constitution in its present shape ought to be supported by all those who are sincere in wishing for amendments. Now, that's just part of that essay, but that is powerful speech and powerful language, and Sentinel nailed it exactly. That first Congress would dictate. Now, if the people had the right, if the Bill of Rights that had been adopted in 1780 and 1791, if that Bill of Rights had been in effect, how in the hell did the Congress pass the Alien and Sedition Acts that forbid writings or negative speech against the government? They didn't work back then. They don't work now. People are deluded with this tub that was thrown to the whale, which came out of a Jonathan Swift story in 1703, something like that. But the people are deluded. They believe they have these rights. And the way it was set up, they do not have these rights.
Today we have the NDAA and the Patriot Act.
Yes. We have those. We have signing statements made famous by George W. Bush, a Republican. We have executive orders that they have all done to violate the Constitution. And in the Amy Barrett's, whatever her name is, I think that's it, proposal for the Supreme Court, the senators were quizzing her about 2 parts of the law that they, most of them, voted for, that are totally unconstitutional, and they have placed the fact of whether they would vote for her or not on whether she will support unconstitutional laws. You know, you can say that's not true, but it is. Because Roe v. Wade.
Amy Coney Barrett.
Whatever her face is, if she was legitimate, no one would have nominated her. If she was going to damage the system that they have set up, she wouldn't have been nominated, I promise you. And I know that's going to make a lot of Trumpites angry. But people look at Trump's people who he has put on the Supreme Court so far. You know, have they proved Neil Gorsuch? Has he proved to be what he was sold as?
Definitely.
Has Kavanaugh proven to be what he was sold as? Will this one... People, you do not get well-supported lawyers do not get positions in the federal courts without they have met certain criteria. In other words, you're not going to overturn these laws that they have put in there. That's why they had the questions today about the Affordable Care Act, which is so unconstitutional, it's incredible. But who was the justice and who was he appointed by who made the deciding vote that made Affordable Care a law anyway?
John Roberts.
John Roberts. Oh, yeah. Now, who appointed him? Which Democrat was it, please?
It was Bush.
So here we have this wonderful man who got there, and he made a blatant lie when he said that it was constitutional because it was a tax, when the very wording of the Affordable Care Act said it was not a tax. So tell me that wasn't a decision made out of whole cloth.
it was a decision made out of blackmail.
Well, there's no doubt about that, but that's my point, Terry. No one is going to get in that position. You know, I was talking with some folks today. Look at Ruth Bader Ginsburg. She was approved 94-3. And Jesse Helms and a couple of other conservative, I use that word loosely, Republicans voted against her. But Bob Dole was the Senate minority leader, and he praised her and said she would be one of the greatest justices ever. And all of these people, every senator who voted for her, knew that she had written in a legal document that sex between adults and children over 12 should not be a criminal act. And they still voted for her for the Supreme Court. People, if you can't figure this one out, you don't deserve freedom. If you can't figure out what they're doing to you, how this is going on, you are watching a soap opera. And someone today on social media said, oh, well, I'll guarantee you that Amy, whatever her name is, knows more about the Constitution than anybody in the room, that entire room she was in. And I just simply said, how do you know that? I got no answer. How do you know she even knows anything about the Constitution? No one asked her a question about the Constitution. They asked her about hyperbole. And how would you vote against this unconstitutional law that we passed? How would you vote against that unconstitutional law that we passed? If she was a danger to the deep state and a danger to this system, she would never have been nominated, people. It's real simple. So you want to get into some of the discussions that place?
I've always said that the Constitution does not defend itself, and neither do our rights. Our rights don't come from a Constitution. So the Bill of Rights, everybody always calls it constitutional rights. Well, they're not. They never were. The mere terminology of it being a right means it's not a privilege. It's a right. It's inherent. It's something we had before. If it had to be given to us, it would not be a right. But if we expect to have any rights, we have to defend those rights. And even if we expect this Constitution, as ill-conceived as it was, whatever part of it that we wish to defend, we've got to defend it. It's not going to defend itself. So, you know, thinking that we even need the piece of paper to somehow protect our rights is lunacy.
Well, I can't argue that at all. But, Terry, you're not going to convince the majority of the people who have said just exactly what you said is not true. Well, it's our constitutional right to do this. It's our constitutional right to do that. No, it's not. You know, one of the things that I thought was very good, and I would have you finished with your thought? I would like to move on to reading some of the debate about the Bill of Rights. If you're ready, Terry.
I'm ready. Go for it.
Okay. Well, the committee had kicked these amendments out, but yet they brought them on to the floor, and They kicked them out, and James Madison then didn't even list them in his list that he made up. But a gentleman from South Carolina, Thomas Tudor Tucker, kept bringing them back up in the Congress. Now, he knew that he was fighting a losing battle because the Anti-Federalists didn't have the votes, and he knew it. But he made a valiant effort. He kept bringing these amendments that the committee had kicked out and that Madison had forgotten. He kept kicking them. He kept bringing them back up. So Mr. Tucker from South Carolina, this is from the official records out of the Library of Congress. It says, Mr. Tucker from South Carolina moved the following as a proposition to be added to the same. And I quote, the Congress shall never impose direct taxes, but where the monies arising from the duties, imposts, and excises are insufficient for the public exigencies, nor then until Congress shall have made a requisition upon the states to assess, levy, and pay their respective proportions of such requisition. And in case any state shall neglect or refuse to pay its proportion pursuant to such requisition, then Congress may assess and levy such state's proportion together with the interest thereon at the rate of 6% per annum from the time of payment prescribed by such requisitions. Now, as soon as he brought this back up, he gets hit with the Federalists. And one of them is a legislator from Virginia, Page. And he said that he hoped every amendment to the Constitution would be considered separately in the manner this was proposed, but he wished them considered fully. It ought to have been referred to the Committee of 11. He did not, the Committee of 11 had kicked this out. He wanted it to go back to the Committee of 11. So these machinations that these people pull in Congress today are not new. They've been doing them forever. And he said, this was the manner in which the House had decided upon all those already agreed to, and this ought to be the manner in which this should be decided. He should be sorry to delay what was so nearly completed on any account. So here's a congressman saying, oh, we're almost finished, and he had to bring this up again. So let's send it back to the committee where it was to start with so they can kick it out again. He didn't say so they'd kick it out again, but he knew that they would. And he said, the House has but little time to sit on this subject and it has to be sent to the Senate. Therefore, it requires of us all of the expedition we can possibly give it. So let's not talk about anything that he's bringing up. I would prefer putting a finishing hand to what has been already agreed to and refer this to the Committee of 11 for their consideration. And then Thomas Tudor Tucker responds. He says, this proposition was referred to the committee along with many others in the growth, but the Committee of 11 declined reporting upon it. I understand that it to be in any gentleman's power to bring it forward when he thought proper, and it was under this influence that I proposed it, nor do I conceive that it to be an improper time. The House is engaged in the discussion of amendments. They have made some progress, and I wish them to go on to complete what they have begun. This may be added without inconvenience if it meets the sense of the House, but if it does not, I wish my constituents to be acquainted with our decision on the whole subject, and therefore hope it may be decided upon at this time. So Tucker was trying to make them vote on this so that their vote would be recorded. And these slimy people, Federalists back then, just like they are now, did not want to go on record voting for taxes again, just like they don't want to go on record today doing it. So they slide it through some committee or through something else. Pardon me. So this has always gone on. And it's really frustrating when we see this and to see how this was done. And so I was looking for one particular letter. Now, to deal with this, I would have to first find the point from Sentinel. So here it is. Okay. Now, listen to this. This was in one of Sentinel's essays, one of the $930 essays. And Sentinel says, I have promised a number on the subject of public monies unaccounted for by individuals, now ascertained by late investigation of Congress, but find so extensive a field opened as to require many numbers to treat of the several parts in a proper manner. He's talking about several essays. I shall therefore confine my remarks at present to one paragraph of it. This investigation, after being long suppressed, has at length reached the public eye and is of such magnitude and exhibits such immense peculations on the public treasure by men who now assume the lead in this and some other of the state governments and are among the most distinguished patrons of the new Constitution, as to demand the serious attention of the citizens of the United States at this peculiar crisis of public affairs. Samuel Bryan went on to accuse with ample evidence Robert Morris of stealing millions of dollars as the head financier of the Revolutionary War. And he had well-documented evidence of this. So here was the thing that is, you know, kind of strange, if I can find it, was the fact that a letter, and again, I'm looking, so Terry, if you have anything you want to run in here quickly, that will be fine. But I wanted to bring up that in a letter, Robert Morris, who was accused of this, writes a letter, and this letter is available. And Robert Morris says in a letter to one of his co-conspirators in this stealing of this money, he says that they're bringing up amendments. I don't have it right in front of me at this time. I thought I did. I apologize for that. But he says very simply that if they were to pass a certain amendment, I would hang. He says that in a letter to a constituent. If this Congress passes such amendments, I will hang. Well, you know, ironically, this man who says this in a letter was already a senator from Pennsylvania. He was in the Congress already. He had helped write the Constitution. He had been a delegate to the Ratification Convention, and he was in the first Senate after he had stolen all of this money. And again, Samuel Bryan makes one hell of a case. So he makes this case, and then he comes up with that statement that if they actually do this, I will hang. And then there's various letters in here about, wait a minute, I found it. Robert Morris to Francis Hopkinson, August the 15th of 1789. The House of Representatives are now playing with amendments, but if they make one truly so, I will hang. Poor James Madison got so cursedly frightened in Virginia that I believe he has dreamed amendments ever since. However, is ad captandum, in other words, in confidence. So here's a letter with a man who says if they pass an amendment that will expose me, I will hang. And yet he's serving in the government. Now, somebody please tell me again how this first Constitution was inspired by God with these characters in it. Really? Any
I don't have anything
sir?
To say to that. what is there to say? I mean, there's nothing to say to that.
Well, here's another one, another letter, Theodore Sedgwick to Benjamin Lincoln. Now, Benjamin Lincoln was a general in the Revolutionary Army. And Theodore Sedgwick says this, Mr. Madison's talents, respectable as they are, will for some time be lost to the public because of his timidity. He is constantly haunted with the ghost of Patrick Henry. No man, in my opinion, in this country has more fair and honorable intentions or more ardently wishes the prosperity of the public. Oh, this sounds good. But unfortunately, he has not that strength of nerves which will enable him to set at defiance popular and factious clamors. His systems of amendments we must fairly meet and must adopt them in every instance in which they will not shackle our operations of the government. Let me read that again. His system of amendments we must fairly meet and must adopt them in every instance in which they will not shackle the operations of our government. It is a water gruel business, and I hope will be so managed as only to produce a more temperate habit in the body politic. In other words, they want the people to quit bitching about their rights. Those substantial amendments which would have a tendency to produce a more complete and natural arrangement of the national union, we must despair of attaining at present. Here's what he just said. Those amendments that we need to complete the overthrow of the people, we must, we must despair of attaining at the present. So the people are catching on, so we need to back off of these. And basically what he was referring to was the Judicial Act of 1789, which amended the Constitution for government, not for the people. And it was unconstitutional. And it was ruled unconstitutional by the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court in Marbury v. Madison, but nobody paid any attention to it. It's still used today, and even though he said it was unconstitutional, everybody just ignored him, and they went on with their business. These letters, Terry, tell the story over and over and over again of exactly what they were up to and what they were doing. So, for people today to believe that, hey, you know, wow. You know, isn't this Bill of Rights wonderful? It is not. It is a tub to the whale. And it's just amazing. And if I could read that original from about the tub to the whale from Jonathan Swift, it came in his book. And it was actually a book called A Tub to a Whale. And it was in 1704. And he says, seamen have a custom when they meet a whale to fling him out an empty tub by way of amusement, to direct him from laying violent hands upon the ship. And so then, of course, and I'm reiterating, but Samuel Bryan falls on this, and he says, like a barrel thrown to the whale, the people were to be amused with fancied amendments until the harpoon of power should secure its prey and render resistance ineffectual. So, wow. You know, I look at this and I think about it in so many ways and such frustration, Terry. Think about what the people believe and what has happened to them. So it is absolutely incredible. And a friend just sent me a text, and he said, I have searched the natural database, and the letter from Morris is no longer available. And so I will send that to anyone who would like it, because I have an original, at least an original copy. So that is available. Even if the government is hiding stuff like, 1984, they said they eventually would anyway. So what are your thoughts, Terry? Where do you want to take it from here?
Well, I just think of all the times that I've spoken about the Bill of Rights and defended them. And now I'm just taken back a little bit, because I've always known that they did not grant us any rights. I've always known that they would not defend themselves. But this is a whole other thing that they were used as bait. They were basically put out there to deceive and not to serve the purpose of preserving the rights we already had, but in fact, to set us up so that those rights could be taken. And that sets me back a little bit. It's not making me, there's some anger, but not about learning this or the fact that you've presented this. It's the anger is that we didn't figure this out sooner, that these people were so deceptive and have been deified the way they have. It's rather annoying to believe that no one in my lifetime, in nearly 70 years, ever brought out even a small piece of this truth.
profession while I'm at this, and I can tell you I have been writing articles for 25, close to 30 years, and I can show you a plethora of articles which I have written, which I have said exactly what you said you've talked about. I have said if the people would just lean on their Bill of Rights, because the Bill of Rights belongs to the people. And this, you know, this is a definition of the people's rights. I didn't say it granted them rights, but I've said it's a definition of their rights. And yet, you know, I admit to that. I was wrong. And it was getting into these source documents and going in and reading and beginning to put the pieces of the puzzle together that you realize these things happen. And I will be, again, completely honest and tell you that when I first found these things, Terry, I didn't want to believe it. I seriously didn't want to believe it. I had been so ingrained with this, so indoctrinated like everyone else. Let's just take another one from the Congressional Register, 13 August 1789. You have Mr. Lee. He moved that the House now resolve itself into a committee of the whole on the report of the Committee of 11, to whom it had been referred, to make the subject of amendments to the Constitution of the United States generally into their consideration. Mr. Page hoped the House would agree to the motion of his colleague without hesitation, because he conceived it essentially necessary to proceed and finish the business as speedily as possible, for whatever might be the fact with respect to the security which the citizens of America had for their rights and liberties under the new Constitution. Yet, unless they saw it in that light, they would be uneasy, not to say dissatisfied. He thought likewise that the business would be expedited by the simplicity and self-evidence which the propositions reported possessed, as it was possible that much debate could take place. So then you get Mr. Sedgwick was sorry that the motion was made, because he looked upon this as a very improper time to enter upon the consideration of a subject which would undoubtedly consume many days. The Federalists didn't want to talk about this. And when they had so much other and more important business requiring our immediate attention, they said openly, your rights don't matter. Our government is what matters. And he begged the gentleman to recollect that all they had hitherto done was of little or no effect. Their impost and tonnage laws were but a dead letter. So he's saying, we haven't got the taxes done yet. Forget the people's rights until we get these taxes done. All you have to do is read this stuff. And politicians have not changed. There is no difference in these people. Absolutely not at all. So,
well, my next comment will, this could really annoy some preachers particularly, but, you know, we've gotten into a habit, even going to the churches, the way that people go and attend so-called worship service, and they listen to what is said from the pulpit and apply that as though it is scripture, and they don't read it for themselves. And when they do finally read some scripture, they apply the filter that's been provided to them from the pulpit. It's the same thing here. We've gotten into this habit of not actually understanding plain written language in lieu of whatever talking head, whether it's a preacher or media, says to us, and we create this filter that everything else goes through and changes our thinking. And is it lazy? Yes, it is. It's laziness, because we don't want to actually use our heads a little bit and common sense.
Well, you know, I can't, I certainly could not argue that point or belabor that point. But you know, there is so much here that, you know, that we can look at and look upon, so many, you know, letters And like I said, there's 140 of them. And so what is this? It just absolutely amazed me that we have this. And all of this is available. It's there if people would look. But they won't look. They won't go look. Why? I just can't understand that. And, you know, here's another letter, you know, that I would like to read. Aedanus Burke, who was a congressman from South Carolina, to Richard Hampton. He says, our House of Representatives chair to take up the business of amendments on the last Tuesday in this month. But unless your legislature interpose, we shall make no hand of it, I fear, for it's necessary by the Constitution for 75% of the states to apply for it before amendments can take place. God grant you unanimity in that affair, though I fear he will not. Your high-flying monarchical gentry, and I am sorry to find they abound in New York as well as in Carolina, will oppose all of our amendments. The wealthy, powerful families in general throughout the Union ridicule the notion and will prevent possible amendments taking place. Rely on that. There's just letter after letter after letter. You have to look at these letters, and how can you say these letters are not actual history? Because they're in our – were these people writing lies back and forth to each other to camouflage the fact that everyone was on the same page and everyone wanted the rights for the people? And – you know, Richard Henry Lee to Samuel Adams. Now, here's a good one. The issue of your government election, you know, Richard Henry Lee is proud that Samuel Adams was elected to the Congress in Massachusetts. And he says, the issue of your government election gives me singular pleasure for many reasons, and especially because the hot-headed Federalists, as they call themselves, placed the contest upon Mr. Hancock, John Hancock's proposition to your convention for amendments to our new Constitution. This procedure argues the extremity of art, deception, and impudence in these people, because they joined with the idea as a most happy means of procuring union and obtaining a ratification of the proffered plan, but now that they have gained their point, they are traducing the men and wish to neglect the conditions upon which probably their success was founded. Deceit, whether in public or in private life, seldom fails in the end to injure those who practice it. I wish that were true. I observe that you mention efficient government. I assure you, my friend, my dear friend, that there lives not a man who more cordially wishes for a government possessed of the fullest means for procuring the happiness, prosperity, and security of our union. But for these salutary ends, it is not, in my judgment, necessary to establish a system full of ambiguity respecting old and long esteemed safeguards, whilst the ways in some instances to pernicious exertions of power are left. I might object some fundamental errors.
Who wrote that?
Richard Henry Lee. He was one of the first senators from Virginia. He and William Grayson were the two that Patrick Henry got into office to try to keep James Madison out. You know, and we are told, how many times, Terry, are we told about how wonderful, you know, the James Madison was? We've got all kind of people running out teaching about the Constitution. And so we got, you know, so many of these things, again, out there. You know, Madison,
well, you know, he said a lot of flowery stuff. I mean, you look at you know, some of his writings. I mean, there's good people that are out there using the Federalist Papers to interpret the Constitution and original intent. And you look at statements of Madison like the ultimate authority lies with the people alone. And he didn't believe that.
Well, Well, look at Federalist 45, where he said the powers of the federal government are few and defined, while the powers of the states are many and unlimited. Was he lying?
Yeah.
He said that, and there are people now, 10th Amendment Center, and people who run around preaching the Constitution, who will sing that with his praises. Look what Madison said. That's not how he voted, people. That's not how he voted. And here's the one that about the 10th Amendment that I think is crucial, and I don't see anybody covering this. Madison, and I sent this to you, Terry, but I'm going to read it. Madison revealed an important element of his constitutional philosophy during the debate on what would become the 10th Amendment to the Constitution. As introduced, it read, and this is introduced from the committee and from Madison, this is the way it read. The powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution or prohibited by it to the states are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. Now, that's the way it reads today. That's the way it was adopted. But Congressman Thomas Tudor Tucker of South Carolina proposed the addition of a single word expressly. It thus would read, the powers not expressly delegated to the United States by the Constitution nor prohibited by it to the states are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. Here, Tucker was making a last-ditch attempt to salvage language from the Articles of Confederation, Article 2, of which declared, each state retains its sovereignty, freedom, and independence, and every power, jurisdiction, and right which is not by this Confederation expressly delegated to the United States and Congress assembled. James Madison opposed Tucker's amendment, however, arguing that, and I quote, it was impossible to confine a government to the exercise of express powers. What James Madison said right there is the government should have any powers it wants, and you can't confine them to the ones that are listed. That's what he said. He said there must necessarily be admitted powers by implication, implied powers to government. James Madison said that. He didn't support the 10th Amendment, supported the government having unlimited implied powers. And implied powers is what the Anti-Federalists said would destroy this country if given to the government. And that is exactly true. He said there must necessarily be admitted powers by implication unless the Constitution descended to recount every minutia. But he had said in Federalist 45 that it should be down to every minutia. Then when he got in power in Congress, he changed his tune. I wonder why. Here again, Madison invoked the need for implied powers, the Anti-Federalist nightmare. Tucker's amendment failed twice, first in the Committee of the Whole and then in the full House by a 32-17 vote. He did convince, evidently, some Federalists to vote with him because there were only, he convinced six of them because there were only 11 Anti-Federalists in the House. The charge would have had dramatic consequences. The Tucker Amendment would have greatly diminished congressional authority under the Necessary and Proper Clause, which had granted Congress substantial discretion to carry out responsibilities assigned by the Constitution. At least it would have created tension within the document, undercutting those who sought to interpret the government's powers in the broadest possible way. So there's Madison for you. Not trying
what do you,
to
what do you call it? Syllogistically,
yes,
their refusal to put the word expressly in there proves that their original intent was not what we have seen even in the Federalist Papers. It proves
absolutely
that their original intent was to do exactly what Lysander Spooner said, and that is to either authorize what we have or to render it impotent to prevent it.
Well, that has
there's no reason why there's, if they were sincere, the word expressly wouldn't have bothered them.
Exactly. Why would they have cared? They would have been for the word expressly. They would not have been against it. They would have been for it. So
I think we need
again,
to put it back in.
Again, we are delusional. Because look what happened. Because after the Constitution was signed in September, where did James Madison go? James Madison left Philadelphia and went to New York to sit with Alexander Hamilton and John Jay to write the Federalist Papers. So they went on a marketing campaign. It had been planned ahead of time. They went on a marketing campaign to write a series of letters to push ratification of the Constitution. And one of the reasons, in my opinion, and I sell it for what it's worth, but one of the reasons, in my opinion, that the Anti-Federalists failed is there was no they had not had a plan for this. They didn't know it was coming. They weren't prepared. They had no unity. They had no organization. They just opposed it on the state level, whereas the Federalists were pushing it everywhere. And that's why the Federalists ended up with complete control of the first government, because they had a plan in place and they put it to use. So, any other thoughts here, Terry?
Oh, I'm sorry, I muted myself for just a second, but I was just saying that the banksters are tremendous planners. These Luciferian cabals are, they plan generations in advance, and it gives them a great advantage over the general populace, that because you don't see the setup coming because it's so far in advance of how it develops, you don't see it coming at all. I mean, it is the ultimate frog in the pond situation, because the general populace, a lot of people don't plan what they're doing tomorrow, much less what's happening 40 or 50 years from now. And these guys do that. And if we want to keep pace with them, if we want to be able to resist this the synthesis of their Hegelian dialectics, we've got to anticipate that. I mean, look at you served in military intelligence for 30 years. How much time was spent just figuring out how you might react to different scenarios?
Terry, everything goes into that. And I can remember being told very early on that, okay, we would say, okay, here is our goal to be accomplished. Okay, now we have to understand that there is the rule of unintended consequences. So here is what we want to implement. Here is what we want to see happen. All right, I want you to take this, and I want you to go create a plan for me that has a plan. You have plan A, you have plan B, plan C, and pardon me, but this was the way I was told, you have plan A, plan B, plan C, and the oh shit plan. You plan for every contingency, regardless of what happens. You plan for that contingency. You make up everything that could go wrong, and you make a plan to cover that. And that's exactly what the Federalists did. They had a plan for everything, regardless of what the Anti-Federalists came up with. They had a plan to counter that. And the Anti-Federalists went into this battle with the best people, with the best ideas, with all of the great intentions, because they went into this for one purpose, not to make money, not to create revenue. They went into this battle to fight for the rights of the people. And that is the very reason that the Anti-Federalists were removed from any books in academia for over 100 years in this country. You could not tell the American public what these Anti-Federalists were trying to accomplish.
You got about 6 minutes left, just so you know.
Okay. Well,
do you
want
to get
anything?
Is there any other letters? Any other letters you want to get into?
Oh man, there are so many letters, Terry. It's incredible. Let me see what I can come up with here. I know there are more. Okay. Let me see what I have here. Okay. Let's look at, here's a letter from William Ellery to Benjamin Huntington. Okay, and he says, I don't hear a word about amendments. Money is indeed the first and most important object. Oh, my goodness, these Federalists just lay it out. Neither civil nor military wheels can turn easily without it. But it had seemed to me that the delegates from those states, which had ordered them to move and urge amendments, would have started them as soon as a Congress was formed. I am glad that a matter of much greater consequence has been brought upon the tapis, and perhaps it would not be amiss to try whether the new government would not do without any alteration. It is probable whenever amendments are proposed, some degree of ill humor may take place of that harmony which I am told prevails, and I hope will prevail in Congress. Okay, and then let's see. There's got to be another good one here somewhere. Let's see. Tench Cox. Are you familiar with Tench Cox?
Just a little.
Do you know what his nickname was?
No.
His nickname in the colonial world was Mr. Looks Both Ways, because Tench Cox was he was accused. Well, they knew that he traded with the British during the Revolutionary War as a merchant. They knew he helped provide the, and there was even rumors at the time that Tench Cox was a had actually served in the Redcoat Army. But for whatever that's worth. But here is a letter from Tench Cox to James Madison. It is very certain that the attention paid by the old government to the overtures of Spain and the resolutions relative to the navigation of the Mississippi were improper and in principle dangerous in a free country. You and I have talked about this, that Jay Gardocki Treaty, and that is where that northern states were willing to turn over the Mississippi River to Spain for 30 years to prevent the western states at that time, anything west of the Appalachians was the western states, to prevent them from having an avenue of trade and forcing them to come through New England to trade. And because of that, several of those states, including Kentucky and even Georgia and North Carolina, actually sent out feelers to Spain to become part of Spain because the Yankees, wonderful Yankees in New England, had shut them down from trade on the Mississippi River in a treaty with Spain. So that happened way back then. So this discord between the North and the South, Terry, started from the very beginning. It was nothing new.
So, yeah, people, I don't know that how much people recognize the importance of the Mississippi, because the Cumberland, the Ohio, the Tennessee River, all of those feed back over in to the Mississippi River, and they didn't have that canal that now cuts off of the Tennessee River and down to the Gulf of Mexico. That wasn't in existence at the time. They couldn't get a ship through there. So everything coming out of the western side of the Appalachians all fed back over to the Mississippi to get down to the Gulf. And, you know, unless somebody's familiar with their geography, they may not know that.
Well, that is true. And let me jump in here with a letter from James Madison to Edmund Randolph. And he said, on the subject of amendments, nothing has been publicly and very little privately said, such as I am known to have espoused, will, as far as I can gather, be attainable from the Federalists, who sufficiently predominate in both branches, though with some the concurrence will proceed from a spirit of conciliation rather than conviction. Connecticut is least inclined, though I presume not inflexibly opposed, to a moderate revision. A paper which will probably be republished in the Virginia Gazettes under the signature of a citizen of New Haven unfolds Roger Sherman's opinions. Whatever the amendments may be, it is clear that they will be attempted in no other way than through Congress. Now, this was what was scaring them to death, Terry, because Patrick Henry was pushing for a new convention, as I mentioned earlier. Patrick Henry wanted a brand new convention to go back. And this, the Federalists were just apoplectic about this. And so they were doing everything they could to stop it. And he said, he's glad that they will be attempted no other way through Congress. Many of the warmest of the opponents of the government disavow the mode contended for by Virginia. In other words, what he was saying, Patrick Henry was leading many in Virginia in a movement for an entirely new convention, which was most alarming to the Federalists, who didn't want to see their work toward consolidation overturned. So,
Mike,
yeah, there's
you'll we'll have to close with that because we're out of time. Final 2 minutes.
Right, buddy.
I mean, final 20 seconds. I'm sorry.
Oh my goodness. So anyway, I've got a study group on Messenger on Facebook for anyone out there who's on Facebook who would like to join. We're looking at all these letters, and we're going to go through all 140 of them before it's over.
Bless you, my man. I sure appreciate your lessons. You keep educating me, and I appreciate it. I know our listeners do, too. Check out Mike's show on Sunday nights called Addicted to Your Own Destruction. What time is that, Mike?
That it will be 6 o'clock Eastern on Sunday evening, and we're going to be talking about Isaiah and the Remnant.
Oh wow, I got a plan for that one. That's on Revolution Radio. You can get it at freedomslips.com at 6 o'clock Eastern Sunday night. Good night, Mike. Good night, everyone.
Good night, Terry. Thank you, buddy. Good night, folks.
Please welcome Disturbed.
Darkness, my own friend, I've come to talk with you again, because a vision softly creeping left its scenes while I was sleeping, and the vision that was planted in my brain still remains within the sound of silence. In restless dreams I walked alone, narrow streets of cobblestone, neath the halo of a street lamp I turned my collar to cold and damp, when my eyes were stared by the flash of a neon light that split the night and touched the sound of silence. And in the naked light I saw 10,000 people, maybe more. People talking without speaking. People hearing without listening. People writing songs and voices never shared. And no one dared disturb the sound of silence. Well, say now you do not know. Silence like a cancer grows.